Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Wednesday's summit between President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin only offered a few steps towards a better U.S.-Russian relationship. But one possible small positive development were the discussions on cooperation on cybercrime and ransomware attacks. Today, digital media is often a geopolitical tool and sometimes a geopolitical weapon. As my guest today points out, we've come a long way from digital media and tools being considered a bulwark for openness and against nationalistic tendencies. Dr. Randy Kluver is the Dean of Global Studies and Partnerships at Oklahoma State University, where he's a professor in the School of Media and Strategic Communications. He was one of the first academics to draw attention to the geopolitical consequences of the rise of digital media. He was the founder and executive director of the Singapore Internet Research Center. And there, he was a principal investigator of the use of the Internet in elections around the world. More recently, he was a principal investigator on an analysis of global media coverage of the 2016 U.S. presidential election. He's held posts at Texas A&M University and Nanyang Technological University in Singapore, among others. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations earlier this week, speaking on the geopolitics of new media. And he's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Professor Kluver, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You know, once the internet and new media was thought to be a liberalizing element in promoting democratic government, I think when we first saw how new media could be used, we thought it would promote free thought and speech. But today, to people on both the left and the right, it's often thought to be a tool of repression, a tool to stifle speech, and a tool to disrupt societies. What happened?
Quite a bit happened. If you go back to the late 1990s, there was a very famous writer by the name of Perry Barlow who wrote this famous manifesto called The Declaration of Independence for Cyberspace, in which he argued that traditional political, legal obligations just didn't apply. And he was what you might call the first of these cyber utopians. Later, of course, a number of other people said that. Nicholas Negroponte, who was at the time was the director of the MIT Media Lab, said, in the future, our children are never going to know nationalism because the internet is going to bring so much exposure and they're going to, you know, they're not going to have all these biases and prejudices against people. But then what began to happen, though, is we really didn't anticipate what was happening to that media environment or what we might call that media ecology, that information environment, and the way in which the internet both overwhelms us with information but also responds solely to the things that we want. And so a number of people now talk about what we call the algorithmic misinformation. So you think of a Facebook feed that feeds you stuff that it thinks you're going to like, regardless of its truth. And the fact that the overwhelming amount of information means that you get far more choice in what you pay attention to. And so as a result, people tend to seek out information that reinforces their own biases. And so on a national level, we began to see that, wow, this is actually quite destructive. And this is one of my biggest fears for the United States, for example, is just the fragmentation that is certainly abetted by the rise of social media. But internationally, let's go back to 2011, 2012, that very key moment. You might remember the Arab Spring in 2011. And Hosni Mubarak was basically deposed as the president of Egypt, which to the shock of everybody, but that was an online campaign that did that. And at that moment was probably the high point of the positive value of the internet for democratic change. But then what happened? ISIS comes along and exploits those same technologies in very, very destructive ways. And uses those same technologies as what some people have called the technologies of liberation. They now become technologies of terrorism. And so now, of course, we're in a world in which the social media is such an overwhelming part of our experience. And we get sucked deeper and deeper and deeper into it, and we become much more fragmented. So if you go back to the 1970s, even the 1980s, as a citizenry, we all had basically the same sources of information. And you could decide which ones you trusted and which ones you didn't, but now it's just, it's wide open. And so you have no idea what the person next to you is listening to, what they think is true. And so we see this hyper-fragmentation that I think has become a really destructive thing for us.
I want to go back to something you said earlier, which was the idea that the algorithmic aspect of new media. And a lot of that is due to the fact that all of this has been monetized.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it even going back to cable channels and the like, it is based on the fact that we need to see your eyes on our material.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever it takes to get your eyes on that material becomes the basis for decision-making, the editorial decisions a mm-hmm. lot of times, and it determines, so it becomes this endless feedback loop into, you know, a person's viewpoint, because the algorithms are basically feeding whatever subtle biases you have and magnifying it.
That's right. So from a media studies perspective, think about the difference between broadcasting. You made the most money by reaching the biggest audience. And then with the rise of cable in the 1980s, you began to see narrow casting, right? So now you have Turner Classic Movies. And so you see narrower audiences. Well, now we're really at a point of microcasting, where things that are being fed to you that only you see. And so your Facebook feed is a great example of that. It feeds to you only stuff that you've responded to in the past, or stuff that they can reliably predict that you'll respond to. And although in some ways, from a consumer's perspective, the fact that Amazon knows what I want to buy, even if I don't know the name of it, is a good thing. But from a political point of view and from a social point of view, it's becoming quite destructive. And we haven't quite figured out how to deal with it within the context of our political values. Other nations have figured that out, but they have a very different set of political values than we do.
So who has figured that out?
For example, China.
Autocratic countries?
Yeah. So China has used new media and particularly digital technologies quite well. And I've been studying this since the early 2000s, because my specialty is Chinese politics. And so back in the early days, I remember in 2000, 2001, Madeleine Albright said, look, the internet is going to democratize China. Bill Clinton said the same thing. He said, trying to regulate the internet, literally his phrase is like nailing Jell-O to the wall. And so we had this wildly utopian idea that the introduction of information and information technologies in China was going to bring about a radical political change. Just the exact opposite has happened. China has used technology to basically reinforce party orthodoxy, reinforce social surveillance and controls in ways that were really unimaginable. Some of those things have been very productive. So, for example, they used one of the projects was a project that really was focused on tax collection. And using that technology, they were able to minimize a tremendous amount of corruption that was very much part of that system. But now, of course, they've implemented this new social control system where you're essentially everything that we know about you and all your social media use, as well as your personal behavior, is all unified together. And it's a way to really keep the population much more closely under wraps, as it were.
I would think those statements by Western politicians were probably viewed as an existential threat to things like the Chinese Communist Party.
Oh, yeah. And I think that you're right about that. A number of people have said, okay, if you think it's a democratizing influence, quit saying it, right? Because all you're doing is getting them to protect themselves. And so a number of people have argued that that's exactly what's happened. But I think the Chinese were pretty sophisticated. I was in China last year before COVID, and they have this new app called Changhua, or Strong Country App, which every party member has loaded on their phone. And on a daily basis, they're expected to go onto that app, to listen to speeches, to read essays, and then to take a quiz. Well, it's an app, wow, just like any other app that you have on your phone. It actually monitors your progress, and it knows how much you're paying attention, and you take these quizzes. And if you want to move up in the hierarchy, you have to show your due diligence with this app. And so you have to show that you've been a part of these
things. Now, this is just party members, which—
This is just party members, right?
I don't know what the percentage of the public is members of the party, but— say, compared to Russia, it was a fairly small percentage, right?
Yeah, it's probably less than 10%. It's about 90 million people are party members. Uh-huh. But those are the highly influential people, right? They're the gatekeepers for the society.
And they're the nomenclatura, if you want. Right. If you want to throw the Chinese equivalent of that, they're the people that control the doors.
Yeah. Now, not all of them are true believers, certainly. One of my friends who was showing me the app showed me all the ways you can trick it. You know, so you can, for example— play the speech while you're in the shower, and the app doesn't know that you're not listening to the speech, but you have to play the speech.
Right. And probably the quiz is probably pretty intuitive after a while.
Yeah, I think it's fairly easy to guess what the right answer.
That is such an intrusive device.
Yeah.
I'd assume, and of course, you know how China has used surveillance in new media, mm-hmm, to surveil, and, you know, this just absolutely cracks down on any sort of dissent, I
sure.
would think.
Yeah, it does. Let me give you another great example. You might have heard of WeChat or Weixin. The Chinese word is Weixin. It's a fantastic all-in-one app. It's your Facebook and your Twitter and your bank account and your utilities bill all rolled into one. There's one app, does absolutely everything for you. You use it to go to Burger King and buy a burger and to pay for it. You use it to stay in touch with your friends. You use it to post pictures of your cats or your
probably
lunch.
Probably your paycheck
or
goes right into it.
Yeah, and so it's just a fantastic app. But you cannot transmit information beyond your immediate circle of friends. And you also can't use it to organize rallies or protests or large gatherings of any sort. It just doesn't have that capacity.
Is it monitored?
Sure, it's monitored, but it doesn't need to be monitored at a personal level. It's monitored at the systemic level, right? There's algorithms that catch certain kinds of things. Chinese, even those Chinese who are unhappy with the government, of which there are fewer and fewer, by the way, even those who are unhappy with it, find ways around it. You can use, a VPN, or you can use any sorts of technologies to do that. But why? It's so handy, right? And so the other thing that happened, and this is a little bit less true than it was 5-10 years ago, because there has been a reunification of Chinese public opinion. But, you know, for example, you can't find a picture in Chinese social media of Winnie the Pooh. And the reason is because at some point somebody made a joke that said Xi Jinping looks like Winnie the Pooh.
That's
and
right.
So if you wanted
this.
To make a subtle dig at Xi Jinping, you would post this image of Winnie the Pooh. Well, now that just doesn't happen, right? And so, for example, in events like the Tiananmen Square movement of 1989, you just don't find references to any of that on Chinese media at all.
My guest today is Randy Kluver. He's the Dean of Global Studies and Partnerships at Oklahoma State University. He's a longtime scholar on Chinese government and Chinese technology, digital technology, and he was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations speaking on the geopolitics of new media. You know, I was reading about how authoritarian regimes viewed digital media when they first came out, and it's interesting to see that, you know, we see so many societies weaponizing digital media against their adversaries, and they actually viewed the development of digital media as something that was going to be used as a weapon against them.
Sure. And many of them still think that the internet was designed to undermine them. And of course, like I mentioned earlier, we fed that perception by saying, look, this technology is going to democratize you whether you want to or not. And so they began to get very aggressive about their exploitation of that media. China is the best example, where they just said, guess what? We're just going to create our own app. We don't need Facebook. We don't need Twitter, because look at this great app that we have, and everybody agrees that's a great app. If you look at Russia, for example, and of course we're all aware with what happened in the 2016 election, an organization in St. Petersburg was probably one of the primary actors, called the Internet Research Agency. And that agency really fed much of that, the social media that showed up on your Facebook feed and mine. And it was content that doesn't look Russian. There's no Russian text in it. It doesn't have any obvious ties to Russia. But yet, it was designed to really undermine confidence in the American political system. And so we did a study. We did an exhaustive study of global media during that 2016 election. We looked at Arabic, Chinese, and Russian media and the narratives that emerged out of that, how people were talking about American democracy. And one of the things we found is all of our rivals, shall we say, used what they found in American media to tell their own citizens, look what a mess America is. Look at the trivial issues that are being debated at their debates. Look at the craziness that is going on that is part of this process. And somehow they want us to think that that's a better system than the stable meritocratic system that we already have.
That's, you know, that's somewhat of a fair cop, really.
It's not untrue, right?
Yeah, exactly. But that's really interesting. And we know of how Russia used digital tools to disrupt the U.S. during the lead up to that election. And we know that still continues from time to time. But there are many other countries that are also involved in this. I think China. Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about how they're using it internally. China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, these are major countries that are putting information out there to Western democracies, again, undermining, I guess, our society so we're less able to tell them that, you know, we don't like their autocratic tendencies. How are other nations using digital media as a geopolitical tool?
So I think for most nations that are not really engaged in the great power game, right? The big geopolitical power. So Russia, China, the United States, Iran, all of those nations, you're right, really are sort of trying to marshal resources against one another. Russia is clearly the worst of the lot. China to a lesser extent, because China still wants to play with us. They want to play within this system, and they just want us to treat them as a fair partner. But I think when you look beyond that, you see a couple of things. Number one, you might have heard that last week Nigeria shut off Twitter because Twitter shut off or deleted a tweet that the Nigerian president had sent. And so most nations are actually dealing really at that level. So how is this impacting our politics? Ethiopia is another example, right, where you've got this ethnic group in the north of Ethiopia, the Tigray region, which is really in some ways revolting against the central government. Well, guess what? You get no internet because we understand how powerful that can be for organizing opposition. And so what you often see are local battles over information technologies. At the big geopolitical level, though, I think it's limited to a fairly small number of players. Now, if you go to Russia and Ukraine, for example, you've got these massive information battles happening between those two, trying to control that narrative. And it's not just social media. It's all forms of new media, from radio to television broadcasting to YouTube and all of these technologies that are waging these wars. One of the most interesting things that I saw, for example, is, you know, in the South China Sea, you've got tensions between China, Taiwan, Japan, and Korea over who owns which islands.
Or Vietnam, too.
Or Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And so they all have their own special social media feeds designed to reinforce these perceptions and to lay claim to these islands, which actually are of no use to anybody.
Except their territory.
Their territory and they fishing rights and so on and so forth.
Fishing rights, but also strategic because, you know, it can be a chokehold.
Yeah. I was at a university in Korea several years ago, and I noticed in the student union where I was at, there was a closed-circuit television feed of an island. It's obviously just a big rock in the middle of the sea. And it was just, that's all it was. And so I asked one of my friends, what is that? And he said, oh, that's the island the Japanese are trying to take over. We have this broadcast here, so if they ever try to land a boat there, one of our students will see it and can report it. And so, you know, all of these things are used to reinforce national identity. And so if you go back to Nicholas Negroponte, who said, you know, the internet is the end of nationalism. Nothing could be further from the truth.
My guest today is Randy Kluver. He's the Dean of Global Studies and Partnerships at Oklahoma State University, and he was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations speaking on the geopolitics of new media. Well, when you look at how China, you think, you know, okay, Russia and the U.S. were very much involved in the great game, you know, of geopolitics and influencing one another. When you look at Iran, they're sort of a player because of the enmity that exists between the United States.
Sure.
But certainly China wants to be a partner on its terms.
Mm-hmm.
We want to be a partner on our terms.
Mm-hmm.
So what sort of how are they trying to influence? Because I know a lot of what I hear a lot of, at least from China, is they're doing old-fashioned influencing, mm-hmm. you know, think tanks, infiltrating think tanks that are pushing sort of their viewpoint in American political discourse.
Oh, I think they're trying to do that in the same way that every country does. And it's not illegitimate, right? To try to create a context in which people better understand you. China has done two things, though, that do have fairly dramatic geopolitical consequences. One is the Belt and Road Initiative, which is building the infrastructure throughout much of Central Asia, South Asia, Africa, Middle East. And so by building out your railroads and your ports and your radio stations and your television stations, you gain a lot of influence. And that has been an initiative. And by the way, the G7 just agreed to try to put up a competing kind of effort to try to minimize the value of that. The second is China has gone all in on global media. So CCTV, what used to be China Central TV, was rebranded about 4 or 5 years ago. It's called China Global Television, where they hire journalists and so on to really put out very professional media. And again, I'm a media person. I'm a believer in all perspectives. Let's all hear from one another. And so there's nothing nefarious about that in and of itself. And in some ways, think of Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera is considered one of the most honest news outlets there is. In the U.S., we think, oh, it's pro-Islamist. Oh, nothing could be further from the truth.
No, that's
right?
True.
It's a very fair news outlet. And if I were to put China CGTV up with, say, for example, RT, Russia Today, I'd take CGTV any day, right? Because it's a much more fair portrayal. Now, so I don't think there's a problem with what we would call public diplomacy initiatives to try to get your point across.
Mm-hmm.
Where I really do have problems, though, is the active interference like Russia particularly is doing with the Facebook feed. I mean, I've got relatives that the stuff they repost, I know that came straight out of St. Petersburg. Right? That didn't come from Iowa, right? It's designed to sow dissension. And one of the things we found in this 2016-2017 study is just this very clear effort to undermine confidence in American institutions and in our process. Well, of course, then we had 2020. And so you could say, wow, was that effective or what? Because, in fact, we have a huge portion of our population now that thinks the outcome of the election was illegitimate.
Yeah. Now, you're talking about going back to 2016-2017. Do you think this has been going on longer than that, it was sort of under the radar? Because, you know, our polarization has been increasing mm-hmm. dramatically. Well, I would really say for the last 20-plus years.
Sure. But what happened is the maturation of the technologies, right? So Facebook was invented in 2004. Facebook didn't really hit its stride for another 10 or so years where it began to really understand. And by the way, nobody really understands how Facebook works because they won't share that data with us. They have insight into what's happening there that we don't have. And so we don't really understand fully how it works and how the algorithms are set up and how they're working. But I think that what happened is, number one, in 2016, by that time, whatever efforts at rapprochement with Russians were pretty much going nowhere. There was this increasing sophistication and awareness of it. About 5-6 years ago, I went to the U.S. State Department and said they had rolled out some digital diplomacy initiatives. For example, every embassy has its own Facebook page and so on. I said, what are your metrics? How are you analyzing your effectiveness? Well, they're using their effectiveness the same way you do. You know, how many likes do they get? Well, that's a very primitive form.
It really is.
Now, today, they're much further along, right? They're much further along. They're using sophisticated, state-of-the-art monitoring and analytics techniques. But it's just, you know, it's taken us a while to catch up with the impact, because you can't understand the impact until after it's happened.
Of course, in the last few years, we've been looking at, you know, the use of ransomware, and if not state-sponsored, certainly state-tolerated criminal syndicates that have made demands against various countries, but certainly here in the United States. As we speak today, President Biden and Putin at their summit in Geneva announced at least a framework for cooperation against cybercrime and ransomware against critical infrastructure. If that comes to fruition, how important will this be as a development in maybe curbing some of the excesses of the use of digital technology as a geopolitical weapon and geopolitical influencer?
Well, I think you framed it correctly, that there's some continuum somewhere between state-sanctioned versus state-tolerated versus state-ignored. And so if we can at least come to some agreement on frameworks that we will collaborate together to protect certain vital infrastructure, that would be tremendously helpful. But you're always going to have folks who are not under the direct authority or even responding to the government. You know, it's like, how many times have you complained to the Nigerian president, can you get rid of these guys who are asking for my credit card number? You know, so there's just a certain amount that people are not under the influence of the government and can avoid that. I mean, we've got all kinds of anti-spam phone call laws. How many do you get a day? You know, so there's a sense in which we're never going to be able to really eliminate all this. But if we can at least start cutting off the big critical attacks, then that would be tremendously helpful.
And so it's not, they don't have a safe haven so much that you're actively looking for them.
Sure. And if we can get that to that step, I think that would be absolutely phenomenal.
All right. Randy Kluver, we wish you great success at OSU and also talking about the geopolitics of new media. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Randy Kluver is an associate provost and dean of the School of Global Studies and Partnerships and a professor at the School of Media and Strategic Communication at Oklahoma State University. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations earlier this week, speaking on the geopolitics of new media. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.